Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Vital Communities, Serial Capital, and Congregations, How Our Relationships Matter. Presented by Jody Kretzman, number KRJO 2006-06. Let us listen in.
Good morning. I'm Jody Kretzman. I'm from Chicago. Home of the White Sox.
No Cubs.
I live about five blocks from Wrigley Field, but I'm a White Sox fan. So mostly rejoicing these days. I want to talk with you today about a strange hippie French count named Alexis de Tocqueville, and think about him in terms of the 21st century and get into a conversation with you, I hope, about the relationship of de Tocqueville to congregations in the 21st century, and congregations especially, which are interested in working with local communities. So let me back into that in a variety of ways. I think it probably makes sense to give a little background to the work, so I want to give just a couple of minutes summarizing an overview session that I did on Monday. In Chicago, I'm at a place called Northwestern University, where we have a little institute called the ABCD Institute, the Asset-Based Community Development Institute. And from that base, we have been working for the last few decades across the United States and Canada, and now on five different continents in addition to North America, with local communities, particularly with local communities who are struggling. Most of our time is spent in lower income or somehow marginalized communities, but we also have spent some time in less marginalized places trying to think with people about how to build stronger, more vital, healthy communities. And our initial set of explorations, or sort of midway down the path, was collected in a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out, which came out about a dozen years ago, and contains a couple of hundred examples or cases or stories about communities that have figured out ways in often really difficult circumstances to rebuild themselves. So it's a book that's filled with stories about little churches like Bethel New Life on the Bethel Lutheran Church on the west side of Chicago, which started with 30 white folks in the middle of a now black community and decided to stay in the community, become part of the community, and rebuild the community, and is now, rather than a penniless congregation, a thriving congregation which runs a $15 million a year community development corporation and has built over 1,000 units of affordable housing and has created about 2,000 jobs, and whose record now is nationally and internationally looked at. So we collected these kinds of stories where a lot of them were smaller than that, where some local folks got after the drug dealers in the local park and took it back for the community, or where some folks decided that these young people in gangs were worth retrieving and figured out ways in which to make them into carpentry co-ops that redid apartment buildings in the neighborhood, or took a real interest in a school that was completely failing and turned it around with the involvement of parent and community people. So we've been collecting these stories and trying to figure out what they mean, what the lessons are. And to briefly summarize what the lessons are, at the center of every one of these stories was somebody or somebodies who recognized a sort of critical fork in the road in their own activity. They want to make their community better. They're connected to a church. They're part of block clubs. They're interested in their neighbors. What do we do? And what they figured out was not to do first what almost every huge institution in the culture was telling them to do. And that was to look at themselves and their neighbors and their neighborhoods as if their only reality was the half-empty part of the glass, not the half-full part. So they looked at they're told by the Ford Foundation and the United Way and big universities and government programs that their reality is this kind of a reality. They're a collection of needs and problems and deficiencies, and that the better they get at telling the outside world about their needs and problems and deficiencies, the more money they'll get, the more programs they'll get, the more attention they'll get, the more headlines they'll get, the more social scientists they'll get studying them. This is the part of the of struggling communities that they're taught. They ought to concentrate on, make visible. If you're writing a grant, the first page is always this. Give me a needs problem. Give me a needs statement, a problem statement, a needs survey. And they had discovered, almost universally, these people who were doing astonishingly successful things in tough circumstances, they have discovered that this is a dead end. That all it does is perpetuate the idea that we have nothing here and that all of the resources, the full part of the glass, is out there someplace. And our salvation is not in ourselves first, but in other people. We won't talk theologically about that, but just in terms of what we can do in the community. And so, universally, they have thrown out that kind of a map and begun to get very serious about constructing a different kind of idea about who they are and what they have, and they've, I think, come to the conclusion that we've come to the conclusion with them that there isn't a community in the United States, or now I'm pretty convinced globally as well, where there aren't these sort of five kinds of resources, five categories of assets. So a lot of our work is working with communities in very, very different situations, from South Africa to Australia to the Netherlands to inner city Chicago to the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in Dakota, on what it means to get serious about finding these five categories, lifting them up, connecting them, and building a strategy for renewal and a strategy for revitalization based on these five categories. Sometimes this word community is a little mushy. It's hard to get your head around what is a community anyway. And I think what we've been trying to do is to say, well, it really isn't rocket science. If you look at what a community is, it's made up of a variety of ingredients. And here's one way of understanding what a community is. Let's take a look, first of all, at the talents and skills of everybody who lives here and try to figure out what they can do. I mentioned the other day that we now have hundreds of examples of what people have invented and called skills inventories or capacity inventories, where they've gotten very intentional about visiting their neighbors and asking about all the things they can do, and what they love to do. I showed very briefly the other day an example from a soup kitchen in Cincinnati, Ohio, where the biggest African-American Baptist church went to the people who were coming into the soup kitchen and asked them about three kinds of resources, their gifts and their skills and their dreams. And what they found was an astonishing number of skills and gifts and dreams. And once they had found those skills and gifts and dreams, they activated them to transform the soup kitchen so that the soup kitchen became a place where people came together, connected, and everybody cooked and everybody served and everybody both gave and received. I mentioned briefly but didn't show the initial interview used by a set of congregations in the Twin Cities, then called Interfaith Action, now called Isaiah. And this is a simple interview format which they use with new immigrants. They noticed that 8 or 10 years ago that there were a lot of new Hispanic folks from Central America and Mexico in the Twin Cities. And they had the radical idea that these new neighbors who were coming into Minneapolis and St. Paul might have actually had a life before they came there. they might have known how to do something. They might have been engaged in something, right? And so they decided to have conversations with them about what kinds of skills do you have? And have you ever been paid for any of them? Would you be interested in making money with these skills or teaching others? Have you ever tried to make money on a skill and been successful? And they found all kinds of folks who had made tortillas and sold them, made crafts and sold them, sewn dresses and so on and so forth. And then they said, have you ever thought of starting a business at home or in the neighborhood? And they took people's interests, and the first 60 people they found that had some experience in what we would call entrepreneurialism at home, they took them and put them through a pretty rigorous 2-year business planning process. And out of it came a huge community development project in South Minneapolis called the Mercado Central. It's a huge old warehouse that contains about 55 businesses. Run by Hispanic immigrant, and it's become an incubator for the Hispanic economy in the Twin Cities. About a dozen of those businesses have outgrown their little spaces within the Mercado Central, and they've moved out into the streets, so the whole neighborhood is being revitalized. It's become a community center for the Hispanic community in the upper Midwest, and it's also become now a kind of tourist center for non-Hispanic, both African American and Anglo people in the upper Midwest. You go in there and it just feels like you're in Mexico City, except it's Minneapolis and it's indoors, indoors, understandable reasons. So we've been working with folks to think about how to find and activate these five kinds of assets. And what I really want to say a little bit about today is the second and perhaps the third category. The second, the associations and the networks of relationships. I mentioned that when I first started many decades ago to work in communities in Chicago as a community organizer, one of my first and maybe most important lessons was that I would never get anything done in the community if I didn't constantly talk with the group of four women who walked around the community every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. They thought they were just getting exercise. But in fact, what they were doing was they were looking at what was going on. They were sort of making mental notes. They were talking to people. They were figuring out where the bad corners were and where people could gather to have some conversations about the community. They were the eyes and ears and, in fact, heartbeat of that neighborhood. And if I weren't in touch with them, I wouldn't be in touch with the neighborhood. So something about community building brings us constantly to pay attention to these groups. And they are not paid groups. They're the places where people get together to do things that are unpaid, as distinct from the third category of assets, the institutions and professional entities. Also critically important, the schools, parks, libraries, businesses, nonprofits. But those are places where people get paid. And I think one of the real lessons of doing this community work is there's a difference between people getting paid and people just getting together and doing this stuff. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Michael Pellet this morning in Bible study drew a pyramid at one point, a kind of a triangle, and that's the symbol we often use for an institution. It's a hierarchical, more formal kind of way to get things done. It's a perfectly good way to get things done, but it's different from the voluntary associations. And then fifth and sixth, every community has some combination of physical assets, the land, the building, and every community has some kind of economy going on locally. Embedded in a larger place, yes, but every community has people producing things, consuming things, bartering, and so on. It's really interesting, by the way, as I've been doing this for a number of years, to think about Holden Village in terms of these five categories of assets and how Holden works really self-consciously at connecting all of them and sort of making them a kind of a faith-based way of working at community. And so we get in communities across the U.S. and elsewhere all kinds of versions of a community asset map where people have figured out, well, here are some of our local associations and our local institutions. Here are some of the things that our individuals can do and the groupings that they fall into. Here's some of our physical resources. Here's what contributes to the local economy. And on this one, just briefly, we've added a sixth category of assets, which we've been working with a little bit over the last couple of years. We now think it's pretty critical to know about a community. What are its stories? What do people say to each other when they're talking with each other about what this community is? Let me just detour for just a second. Anybody here know the sort of, we think about it as a sort of sister discipline, they're good friends of ours, the discipline of appreciative inquiry? Is that a term that is familiar to anybody? Do you know about that? It's a very powerful way, I think, to have in the John to the conversation. So you want to say a word about how you use it or see it? Or?
Well, rather than knowledge coming at you, it starts with questions and looking at, appreciate what we do have in the resource.
Yeah, yeah. It's a way of starting a conversation in a community, or it can be in an organization. In fact, the work came out of originally work in Fortune 500 companies that was done by people at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. And they were thinking about corporate change. How do you get corporations to change in positive directions? And so they sort of invented this way of having a conversation. That's very simple when you think about it. You go into the place and you begin to talk to people and you ask the question, when were you proudest of this corporation? Or when were you proudest of this community? When was this community functioning at its best? when did you feel most valued in this community? And start collecting stories about that, actual historical, experienced stories about successes. And then the next set of questions is, well, what contributed to that? What were the factors that came together that made that success happen? And then the third step is, how can we make more of that happen in the future? So you're building a kind of hopeful agenda for change for the community or for the corporation or organization. And it's not based on pie in the sky because it's based on actual experience. People have actually experienced what it is you're asking them to think about doing in the future. We've seen this work in congregations as well, sort of think about when people were proudest of the congregation, felt best about it, and what made that happen, and how can we make more of it happen in the future. So that's sort of the stories end of the community assets map. So a lot of the work that we do in lots of different communities and our colleagues do have to do with sort of starting there and then seeing where it goes. What do you do with the full part of your glass if that's what you're starting with and not the empty part? So here's one way a colleague has thought about describing what this is about. She actually did this in Atlanta. She was trying to explain to the United Way what this was, and she in a very simple way sort of said it's moving from a social service model to a community capacity model or ABCD model, and you're moving from concentrating on deficits and to concentrating on assets and capacities, to starting always with problems and pathologies and needs, to moving towards skills and talents and resources, to always focusing on problems and trying to respond to them. That's still important to do, but really more emphasis on where are the opportunities, where are the possibilities, where are the energies here. We used to focus on fixing people, and now we focus on community as the locus of health. So it's not so much fixing individuals, it's connecting them to the health-giving relationships within a community. It's from a funder's perspective, whether you're in government or whether you're in a church hierarchy or whether you're in the Ford Foundation or United Way, it's the shift from charity to investment. The old model is have a community hold out its hand, effectively telling you, we've got more teen pregnancies than anybody else, we've got more ex-cons coming back in the community than anybody else, our crime rate is higher, give us the money, give us the resources, give us the programs from the outside. To an investment orientation, which is really much more demanding for both the funder and for the local community. If you want to invest in something, which of those two maps, the needs map that focuses on emptiness, or the assets map that focuses on fullness, which of those two maps do you invest in if you want to return? The answer is pretty obvious. You invest in community resources that can be brought to bear on problems and produce successful outcomes. This next one is a little bit hard for some people to understand, but a healthy community doesn't need so many services. A healthy community works together, has all kinds of local energies and synergies happening so that people who are trained in social work aren't necessary in that kind of a community. And obviously, the social service model emphasizes outside help a lot rather than turning first to inside resources. So that, in summary, is sort of what the shift is we've been working on for us over the last decades. The adaptations and permutations of this way of thinking have taught us continuously. And so since the publication of Building Communities from the Inside Out, we've done about 16 additional publications that sort of reflect back the community's wisdom, the communities that have been using this way of looking at stuff. So one, for example, is a workbook called A Guide to Capacity Inventories that has the Minneapolis Mercado example in it. It has the soup kitchen example and a bunch of other examples of how communities have created their own ways of getting at people's fullness, their strengths, their energies, and their skills. Another one that gets a lot of use came out a couple, 3 years ago, called Asset-Based Strategies for Faith Communities. And again, it works out of a collection of successful efforts within faith communities, and by that we mean everything from local congregations to judicatories to denominations, and with a stop at seminaries, and there are pockets within the Salvation Army that are trying to work in this way. So it's a variety of faith-based institutions, organizations, and people who are attempting to move. And one of the problems of church people, frankly, is that they need to be needed often, right? That they they're addicted to helping, and that's a problem. And so this is a set of examples and tools and ways of thinking in different ways about how to make change happen. Let me just stop there for a second. That's the general overview here. Is that clear? You want to enter into any dialogue about that or questions about that?
Kind of a funny example, when you first got involved with the city of Portland, was involved in a lot of refugees from Southeast Asia. In the mid-80s, there was a group came from Laos, and their enterprise was growing poppies right along the freeway. It took the police quite a while to figure out what was going on.
Right. 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 Whatever happened to them? Did they ever get to market?
Well, the poppies are no longer there, so okay. They must have moved off to other less
right.
Clear places.
Right.
But they got their own business going pretty quick.
Are there Seattle folks here? Anybody from Seattle? One of our closest colleagues is a guy who founded and for 11 years was the head of the Seattle Department of Neighborhoods. And the Seattle Department of Neighborhoods adopted this way of working with neighborhoods from its inception. And it's very, they use, for example, matching grants for neighborhood energies. They wouldn't grant the money until the neighborhood had organized itself to match the grant money, not necessarily with money, but with energy and with time and with creativity and commitment and so on. And it's just made if you ever did a tour of Seattle neighborhoods with the Department of Neighborhoods, it would be a lot of fun because you'd see everything from trolls under bridges that the neighborhood to neighborhood gardens, lots of gardens. You reminded me of it because every new ethnic group that came in wanted to put together a garden that they were familiar with, right? That had a lot of stuff in it that nobody in Seattle had ever seen before. And then began marketing that to various people within the community. Yeah?
I just want to comment. I'm from Minneapolis. Suburb of Minneapolis. I've never heard of that. Our church is involved in Isaiah, but I've never heard of this project that you described in community. So I'm real anxious to find out.
Okay, it's the Mercado Central. It's right in the middle of South Minneapolis.
South Minneapolis.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place to visit.
So I'm going to go there.
Yeah, I understand that there's a Somalian replica of it that's being created right sort of across the street. So, yeah. Other comments? Okay.
I have one more.
Yeah.
In Portland, we've had a focus on community policing, which I personally have seen a very positive thing happen with, but it's still police, and it's not as tight to the neighborhood as I'd like to see, but is there other models that are really working well in that regard? Or are there?
Yeah. Since the inception of community policing in the mid-1980s, with a couple of guys at my place at Northwestern and a couple of guys at Michigan State, we've been pretty much involved in the discussion as community policing has been attempted in lots of different places. And the difficulty usually, well, there are lots of difficulties with it, but the difficulty is that police are not trained to trust the community. Police, in fact, are trained to mistrust the community and are focused constantly on, and understandably, on the empty part of the community glass. Their job is to find people who are the problems and do something about them. So it's a tough situation. On the other hand, I have never met a police superintendent any place in the United States who did not recognize the absolute truth that police can't produce safe neighborhoods. That's something that's beyond what police can do. Police can catch criminals after the fact, which is a different kind of thing, but they can't create safe neighborhoods. They're only organized blocks, organized neighbors. The study I shared the other day said that two things produce safe neighborhoods. Number one, residents who know each other. And number two, residents who are in the habit of acting in public together, right? That if you've got those two things going, you're gonna have a safe neighborhood. So we've been working with community policing, and I think there's more and more recognition on the part of the smartest cops that in fact, that's the direction to go. Much to our surprise, and take a quick detour here since you asked, about 2 years ago, we got asked by Mayor Daley in Chicago and the Chicago Police Superintendent to try to create a way for the Chicago police to get more serious about community policing. And we were a little surprised to be asked to do that, but we did. And what came of it is something that's being called in Chicago the Community Policing Leadership Development Institute. And we put together a kind of a year-long training program for teams of people, many of whom came out of congregations, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, teams of 3 to 5 people learning basic community organizing skills, how to do one-on-one interviews with your neighbors, how to do kind of asset mapping of the community, how to put together a project. We try to have as many as possible be intergenerational projects to make the community safer, and then how to connect both with existing neighborhood organizations and with the police in a more creative and positive way. And we just, the Saturday I came out here, a week ago Saturday, we had 7,000 people out on Navy Pier. 1,500, the main purpose was to celebrate the fact that 1,500 local residents from communities across Chicago had graduated from this Leadership Development Institute. Tavis Smiley was our keynote speaker, as well as the mayor. And so there's some hope about police departments getting a little bit more serious about community policing. I think it's the only way to go. But it's very, very difficult sometimes to convince people in a military hierarchy that in fact there's another set of energies that they could bring to bear that would make their jobs easier.
So are you talking about things like Block Watch?
Yeah. And lots of other activities too. I mean, I think that creating an intergenerational team, creating a community garden, is a wonderful community safety activity.
What I found really helpful is that the police are a lot more approachable and really interested in a lot more than just driving their car down the street.
That's right.
Out of their car and seeing what's going on in the neighborhood and participating and helping the neighborhood on the projects that they're trying to do.
That's right. And it makes a huge difference to know who the cops are in your neighborhood and have some relationships with them, particularly for young people to have that. Absolutely. Yeah, Kate? It's a wonderful question. It seems to me that there are all kinds of ways for people outside communities to plug in helpful ways. But I think your phrase is a nice one, plug in. Not to come in with the answers or with the programs, but to sort of listen fairly carefully and see what's going on there and begin to see where, where local people might think you might be useful. Where are the places, if you know what you've got in a community, you can begin to see where the gaps might be and where you might be helpful. On the other hand, you don't have to be a community organizer to take very seriously the golden rule of community organizing. Anybody know what that is? All the community organizing networks, hundreds of thousands of people know this across the United States.
Don't do for others what they can do for themselves.
That's exactly right, John. Never do for somebody else what they can do for themselves, right? Right? Always figure out ways to create the space for the folks to do it.
I think Ernie Perpez calls it the iron rule.
It's the iron rule. Yeah. Sometimes it's a golden rule. Golden rule sometimes in church circles.
Yeah.
The iron rule in organizing circles. Absolutely. I once heard Saul Alinsky, who was a sort of father of modern community organizing, answer the question, how do you know a good organizer when you see one? And this, I think, applies to lots beyond organizing. He said, a good organizer is somebody who comes to the end of her day, thinks about what happened out in the community, and can name 10 good things that happened, none of which she did herself. Right? So you're constantly creating citizen space, places for people to powerfully act and get good things done. So I think that's one of the ways to sort of think about being in communities that are not our own. Let me shift for just a second to the associations. A little bit about de Tocqueville. As all of you know, he was the author of what I think is still probably in the top 3 books about the United States of America called Democracy in America. And it was the result of his traveling around the United States in 1830 and 1831. His story is so interesting. It's just like the story of 22-year-olds these days, right? He got out of college in France. He had a wealthy family, wealthy father, and he said, wouldn't you bankroll me to take a trip for a couple of years and backpack or something through the United States, through the New World? And his father said, no, I'm not going to do that. You have to have a purpose to your trip to the United States. You have to have something you're going to study or something you're going to concentrate on. And so de Tocqueville sort of made something up and, and persuaded his wealthy father to support it. Does anybody remember what de Tocqueville actually came over to the United States to study? He heard about this wonderful new invention over here, and he wanted to come over and study it. No? It was the penitentiary. He had heard, right, that these crazy Quakers in Pennsylvania had figured out a new way of addressing people who had somehow wronged the community, and they would put them apart in a place where they could be penitent, right? Where they could contemplate their wrongdoing and come to some kind of repentance about it. And he was interested in that and came over and, boy, there's an idea that went wrong at some point. So he came over to study penitentiaries, and he arrived here and immediately got fascinated by a whole lot of stuff beyond penitentiaries. The penitentiaries just went to the white wayside, and he started looking at other kinds of stuff. And Democracy in America is still an incredibly smart book about, you know, some of the tensions between individualism and the state and groups and so forth. He ended up, though, at the center of Democracy in America, and he's writing this not for us in the United States, he's writing it for Europe, for back, he's reporting to the old world what this new world is about, right? And he says, basically, his two most important messages are this. Number one, he says back to Europe, you know, this is a really interesting new country, but they've got a problem, and they're never going to be able to survive as a nation unless they get rid of slavery. That slavery is at the center of what will break up anything that's potentially positive in this new world setting. And he knew that. He talked all over Europe about that. And was a very, very powerful messenger about slavery. But the second thing he said was, if they figure out how to get rid of slavery, they've got a real step up on the rest of us in terms of how they understand democracy. Because we think over here that democracy has to do with maybe getting rid of peerages and inherited status and all of these titles we've got and substituting for it some elections and electing people. But he said, in America, they've got a different idea. And sort of one of the core statements from Democracy in America is this: Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all dispositions constantly form associations. They have not only commercial and manufacturing companies in which all take part, but associations of a thousand other kinds, religious and moral and serious and feudal or general or restricted, enormous or diminutive. The Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns, construct churches, to diffuse books, send missionaries to the Antipodes. In this manner, they found hospitals, prisons, and schools. And if it's proposed to inculcate some truth or to foster some feeling by the encouragement of a great example, they form an association, a society. Wherever at the head of some new undertaking you see the government in France, or a man of rank, person of rank in England, in the United States, you will be sure to find an association. So these are the voluntary groups. Every Tom, Dick, and Mary, he's saying, gets together. Nobody elects them. Nobody selects them. But if they want to make, they want to board the sidewalk up and get rid of the muddy sidewalk, they just go out and do it, right? If you think about it, it's just logical. This is the only way frontier communities could be put together. So he said that there's something about this that is at the core of a democratic experiment, which is critical and which is different from anything else we've seen on Earth so far. The United States has always been thought of as the place where this kind of activity is at its richest. We now see different versions of it across the globe. Sometimes it's kin-organized or extended kinship networks or villages or tribes or a variety of ways of having groups go at problems and be the core of the community. But fast forwarding to the United States, in the last 5 years, there has been a pretty heated argument about how healthy this part of the United States culture is. How many people here have read anything by Robert Putnam, like Rolling Alone? Some of you have, just a quick set of, okay. Let me just summarize the argument briefly. A little bit of background. Robert Putnam is at Harvard. He's a political scientist. He started out as an international scholar. He did a wonderfully interesting book in the late 1980s called Making Democracy Work. And Making Democracy Work is a report of a study he did in Italy. He went to Italy in the early 1980s, which, if you remember, is the beginning of the Reagan era here in the United States. In Italy, the government did exactly the same thing that Reagan was trying to do in the United States and that Maggie Thatcher was trying to do in the UK. Rome was interested in taking some of its authority, some of its power, and diffusing it into the regions. Italy is made up of 12 regions, sort of more like our states. And so there was a concerted effort to take some real political, governmental authority and power out of Rome and put it out into the states. We were experiencing decentralization or devolution at that point in the states. Italy did the same thing. And Putnam was interested in figuring out whether that worked. What does it mean out in the actual communities of Italy to have this new set of authority? And what he found was pretty interesting. He looked at, over a few years, whether the new authority that Rome granted the regions made a difference. Did it make things better? Was it making a difference in the community? And he defined making a difference in two ways. Number one, did it make an economic difference? Are more people working? Are there more signs of a vibrant economy in this region? And number two, did it make a political difference? Are more people participating? Is the democracy more vibrant in this region? And he found six of the regions, the answer was clearly yes. Economy and polity both improved. And six of the regions, nothing happened. Four things got worse. Same authority, right? Same stuff coming down from Rome. And in six of it didn't. He said, why is that? And so he started trying all kinds of answers and looking at all kinds of explanations. And what do you think he came up with? What was it? He tried urban, rural, rich, poor.
Rich and poor.
Didn't work. What finally determined whether or not the new authority really did make a difference was the density of soccer teams. Right? How many sports clubs were there here? How many cultural clubs? How many women's groups? How many labor groups? In other words, it was the associational richness of a community that made all the difference. It's like, in some places, this associational part of the community formed a soil, a rich soil, which then you could plant something political in, and it would grow, and it would flourish. And it was because it's in this set of relationships in our communities, in the associations, that people develop trust in each other, learn how to work together, have the experience of making something positive happen. This is another way of understanding congregations. A congregation is one form of aggregated social capital at the local community level. And when we understand it in that way, we are open to all kinds of possibilities of ways in which it can grow. So Putnam, having discovered that the density of soccer teams was the major determinant of whether or not things worked in Italy, came back to the United States in the late 1990s and decided to look around here. This has always been the hotbed of associational life globally, right? What's going on here, he asked. And he did a very, very thorough set of studies of a variety of national data sets about how our associational life looked at the end of the 20th century. And the more he looked, the more disturbed he became. The more it seemed to him, that since about 1972 or so, something about that, that our associational life has been dwindling. That there are fewer and fewer elks clubs and moose clubs and other animal clubs, that there are fewer and fewer people participating in PTA, and there are fewer and fewer Kiwanis in the United States, and there are fewer and fewer people participating in local government, that the voting patterns have declined, that a variety of indicators said that our associational life was pretty much going into the toilet. And he began sort of preaching that around the United States, and I think getting a very, very often sympathetic kind of an audience. And his findings became very influential in terms of policy directions that people here became interested in. Our work began intersecting with Bob Putnam's work from the bottom up, because a lot of the people we were working with in communities thought that this did not resonate with what they knew, that what they thought they had in their local community was a much richer set of local associations than any of Putnam's work pointed to. So we started working with friends in lower income communities. Here's one quick example. This is a low income community on the west side of Chicago, mostly African American. And this is what some friends out there found in just a 4 week period constituted. This is a community of maybe 25,000 people. They found 612 local associations of a whole variety of types, 204 religious congregations. Religious congregations, among other things, spin off groups, so they found 59 of those, 35 music organizations, 31 block clubs, 29 youth support. This is a low-income, working-class African-American community.
Population?
About 25,000. sports groups, retiree support, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There were two kinds of reactions to this. When they did this work, they showed it to the existing community leaders in that neighborhood, and what they quickly discovered was that no existing community leader, many who had lived there for decades, knew more than about 5% of the groups. So it was revealing a whole set of relationships of important community assets that they hadn't been aware of before. They also got that kind of reaction when they just talked to ordinary residents about the list. Wow, look at what we've got here. But the second kind of reaction they got from ordinary residents was, that's interesting, now where's my group? And people began adding to this. You can never sort of do a final count of these things, right? So within a couple of months, this initial group of 612 had grown to over 1,000 as people began adding the groups that hadn't been caught the first time around. Now, in terms of Putnam's work, we've been talking with Bob Putnam and others about how many of these groups could you see if your only lens was national data sets. How many of these groups would show up in the way that Kiwanis show up, or in the way that PTAs show up? And the answer, I think, is not very many. That there's something here at the grassroots level, at the local level, that you can't see from Harvard or Washington, D.C., but that it's an incredibly important part of community building. Another kind of discussion we're in constantly with Bob Putnam and his colleagues is, it's an important question to ask what's happened to associational life over time. What's that historical trajectory look like from early 1970s on? But it's maybe more important from a community building point of view to say, okay, no matter what it looks like over time, what do we have now? What's the starting point? Because this is the critical place where people are already out the door. Let me just finish these remarks about associations by showing you a simple version of, we've done a number of these, that some are more complex than this, about why this is important. We now think that a lot of the most important community building work in communities, in neighborhoods, is invisible, and it goes on in these groups. And it doesn't go on necessarily, most importantly, in the paid groups, in the groups that get the grants or that get the government money. It goes on in these groups. And the second thing we're becoming convinced of is that these groups, which are normally shut out
of formal community development or community planning activities. They're not asked to the table. That these groups, when asked to the table, bring an important set of new resources that are willing and able to be part of the community building, community development process. So let me real quickly show you the results of some conversations we had in another neighborhood in Chicago, a second poorest neighborhood in Chicago. They did a similar thing like this, came up with 320 groups, and then they categorized them like these categories over here. And they found 21 categories. It looked like these 320 groups had 21 categories. And so they randomly picked a group from each of the categories. Are you following me here? Right. So you got a sports group, you got a youth group, you got a women's group, you got a block club, you got a cultural group. And they went to the leadership of that group and had extensive conversations with them about what the group actually does and what it would be willing to do that it's not doing, right? So let me just show you real briefly. We've got 21 groups here. First set of questions. Here are some typical neighborhood projects. And you can work on neighborhood beautification or with young people or seniors or supporting families or improving neighborhood health or neighborhood safety. Out of 21 groups, look at this first column. This is those that have already done something. And it's interesting. Look at the 15 groups out of 21 that say we've done something working with young people. If you look at the titles of the groups, follow me here, only 3 of the 21 look like they'd be working with young people. But 15 say they already do. So there's the actual activity is invisible if all you have is the title of the group. Same thing working with older adults or improving neighborhood health. And then the second column is one that we tend to be really interested in. Groups that say, well, we haven't worked with young people yet, but we'd be willing, let's talk. What can we usefully contribute to the lives of young people here? So in a sense, if we want to use the jargon here about social capital, these groups represent social capital, all of the ways in which people relate to each other in important ways. This second column represents unused social capital that's there, that's ready to be used. The third and fourth columns are, we don't know, really. We'd have to go back and talk to our members. We're uncertain. And the final column is we're not willing to entertain doing that. Let me show you another couple quick examples. Here are a bunch of issues in neighborhoods that usually the paid human service agencies take charge of. Teen pregnancies, child abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, youth truancy and gangs, taking people with disabilities back in the community, taking people coming out of jail back in the community. And here you'll see that in the first column, many, many fewer out of the 21 have already done this work. So only 4, for example, have worked on child abuse, only 3 on teen pregnancy. But look at the second column. On average, about half of the groups say, well, we'd be willing to be part of that. Let's think about how. What makes sense for our block club to do about child abuse? What makes sense for our cultural group to interact with teen pregnancy? So again, we think there's a vast but untapped set of resources here. Let me show you one other quick one. This is about local neighborhood economies, and this is a bunch of ideas that people always use to sort of rebuild neighborhood economies. Let's talk about starting or attracting new businesses in the neighborhood, buying at new businesses, investing in new businesses, buying at existing local businesses, that is having some kind of a buy local campaign, improve the business climate, invest in the expansion of local businesses, get banks to provide, close on undesirables. So look at the first column here. Almost none of the groups have done this. Almost none have been involved in economic development at the local level. But look at the second column. Anywhere from half to 3/4 of the groups say, of course we'd be willing. This, you know, local economy is really important to us. Of course we'd be willing to be involved in working on strengthening the local economy. So we're now very, very interested in, for example, all of the ways you could think about a choir as a community development group. Right? How is a choir a potentially powerful economic development engine? Can the employed people in the choir be bridges for unemployed people in the community and maybe young people into employment, since we all get our jobs from connections? That's one of the things that social capital does for us, is to connect us into the world of economy and work, right? Can the choir sing at benefits? What are the multiple things a choir choir could do in the course of being a choir that also builds the local community. Is that clear? See, one of the problems, I think, finally, in a community setting is that fairly frequently when I get called into a community to meet with the community, say, we come and meet with the community leadership, and it's always wonderful people, energetic people, people with high levels of commitment to the local community, but when we figure out who we are around the table, it becomes very, very clear that almost everybody there is paid to be there. Almost everybody there is there because they have a paid position, and they're critical to have there. You want the high school principal there, and you want the police commander there, and you want the elected official there. But what that does is to shut out of the process 95% of the people. And the temptation is to say, well, the rest of the people aren't here because they're not interested, because they're apathetic, they don't care. Nonsense. They care plenty when they've got something that they're interested in, that taps into their excitement and their passion. If they love to sing, it's the choir. It's our problem that we look out at communities and see a bunch of apathetic people. I don't believe in apathy. I do believe there are a lot of people who have never experienced success in civic or public activity. And that's a different thing than apathy, right? I think we can create situations in which people can experience that success. And a lot of that creation, I think, will come by being attentive to the networks and associations in local communities. Does that make sense? Let me just stop there. I want to have your help sort of translating this, particularly into a congregational setting, since in so many communities, particularly the kinds of communities we tend to work in, lower income communities, African American communities, Hispanic communities, you know, unlike maybe some upper middle class or Anglo communities, if you're working in lower income communities, you have to work with churches. They're there. Yep.
Oh, I've been involved in volunteerism as a volunteer in a lot of different ways all my life. That's sort of my specialty as a volunteer.
Yep.
When people ask me what I do, I don't get paid for what I do, so I always write community volunteer. Anyway, I see the tremendous value of volunteers, but I also see volunteers who know what they're doing can plug into the professional stuff that helps you. For example, in Vancouver, Washington, in an ecumenical way, a bunch of churches, we met together, and we said, we've got all this space in our churches, and we have all these homeless people, let's solve it. And so we talked about it, and we got it organized, and we now have a tremendous system whereby many homeless people during the winter months have places to go, but we couldn't have done it by ourselves.
Yep.
We have this quality people in the churches, we get all the volunteers from all these many churches, but we needed the social workers who could do the intake so that it's a safe situation, because some of our homeless people are good and some are not good. So we have a wonderful cooperative, and I think you need to plug into the expertise of the trained people.
Absolutely.
So what you said about apathy, I'd like to think of it as maybe a lack of knowledge and a lack of network rather than apathy, because I really believe what you're saying, that it could be there, you just don't know how to get it going.
Right, right. And I also think sometimes we're not attuned enough to people's real passions and interests to react to them in ways that affirm what we're hearing, you know? I mean, I think when I'm talking to somebody in a community and I say, you know, what do you really, if you have 2 hours on Saturday morning, what do you do, right? What's your passion? And if he says, you know, I really love engines and I climb underneath my 1957 Chevrolet every Saturday morning when I've got some time, we ought to hear that as a community building response and maybe be ready to come back and say, would you like to take a couple of 14-year-old kids under there with you one Saturday morning and show them why you're so excited about what you're seeing under there, right? And that's an option to saying to him, would you come to our meeting about the problems we're having with young people? Lots of people don't like coming to meetings, right? It's surprising how often if you ask people, what do you really enjoy most? How infrequently you hear, I love coming to endless meetings. It's just not the first thing out of their mouths, right? So how do we respond creatively to what people's real interests are and use those to create social capital and relationships that, that can be used in a variety of ways, Jenny?
When you mentioned the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, it triggered a memory I had with the spiritual connection. I was there 7 years ago or so working with the Tree of Life Ministry, and there it is, people from outside going in to do stuff for the people there. But one of the people who was in charge of the Tree of Life Ministry said that there was one family in particular that was really strong there, like in education, like the principal of the school, the superintendent of the school. And the thing he thought really made a difference for that family was that they had continued to practice their religion underground at a time when it was outlawed by the United States. And he said that that had kept their family strong. And while there was a lot of hopelessness around the community, that family had maintained hope. And so it seemed like maybe the spirituality of the religion brings in the hope and keeps that alive.
Yeah, absolutely. Almost all the time when we get asked to come into a situation with indigenous people, whether it's in North America or Australia or South America, it is basically we're asked to come in to validate to white folks what the people are already working on in terms of what they've got, their culture, their history, their faith, their spirituality, their religion, their relationships with each other and the way in which they've done things, and how to sort of lift that up as a set of valid resources and assets, if you will, for the larger culture to acknowledge. Yeah, absolutely. Paul?
I just want to share an exciting concept for me as an educator. That this whole fascinating presentation could be a template for education as well.
Absolutely.
Institutional structure, individual instruction and motivation. I'm ready to get out the door. it's a whole new way of thinking, and it can impose itself on lots of our institutions. And anyway, I'm just saying thanks.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
I have a congregational example that came to my mind as you were showing, you know, groups that did one thing but would be willing to do other things. And my congregation has always, and Portland has always, given the money generously towards benevolence, 25% off the top is what we do. But in the last few years, we've been consciously working to include more people in participation as well as giving the money. And so just quickly, the examples I thought of as you looked at that was the choir did do a benefit concert, and a Christ Care group makes layettes for the Letty Owings Center, which is for young drug addicted mothers and their children, and just different. Oh, the Vocation Bible School kids did some things for a work in Tanzania, and so that all the groups within the church, or many groups, are also the church council painted a homeless shelter, and so are involved in social ministry as well.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. I think the challenge always in that kind of work is how do you make it a two-way street?
Absolutely.
How do you set up a relationship that's really receptive to what the folks that you're trying to help also have to give and contribute? Absolutely.
I'm concerned about our church and our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Well, we moved out of the neighborhood because we took the townhouse a little bit away, but the neighborhood where the church is, where we spent 33 years, has been turning over to non-Caucasians, and there's Liberians and Hispanics, other Africans, and the demographics have changed so that our church is dwindling to some degree, although there's still a lot of energy. That's still a viable church and everything, and the offerings are pretty good. And I'm a parish nurse there. But there's a lot of talk about how the church should reach out into the community and do this and that, but nobody's come up with any real system. Or we have this Isaiah group that's working with the education piece throughout
And there's no easy way to do that. I mean, it seems to me that so much of this work is about the labor-intensive job challenge of building relationships with people. You know, our little place in Chicago continuously, as the neighborhood changes continuously, knocks on doors.
Does
one-on-one interviews.
Yep, I brought it up one time in an interview.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're learning to do better, I think, is that the one-on-one interviews are not just introducing Ebenezer Lutheran in Chicago to the neighbors, but it's introducing, it's also asking folks, who are you? Tell me about where you come from. What are your interests? What do you like to do best? And how come, you know, it might not have anything to do with coming to Ebenezer Church, but we know a lot about the neighborhood here, and we can sort of tell you, connect you with some resources and some opportunities here as well. So it's really sort of trying to discover the gifts and capacities of people in the community, as well as introduce them to the possibility that there's this congregation that could be here. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Done.
Well, I come, you know, this is the half the family that's the religious side. I come from the other side, maybe the non-religious side. I'm very active in neighborhood activities, you know, large area. And I found it extremely difficult to involve churches in anything. Not saying we've got something we want you to come and do, but help us in the neighborhood figure out where we ought to go and so on. It's as though the administrations of the churches are afraid we're going to take some of their people's 10 hours, and they're so busy with the busy work of the church, they don't have time to get involved in the community.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it seems to be what, that's my, you know, I may offend people, but that's kind of my sense is that, you know, the churches the administrations of seem to be focused so inwardly. It's hard to get out of it. Maybe you can work on a school one weekend a year.
Yeah. That's a fairly, I think, common complaint among pastors and others who are in charge of churches. This is activity that's going to siphon off my leadership, right? I think two things that I try to gently be in conversation with people who are in those situations. Number one is, I think one of the jobs of congregational leadership is to constantly expand the group that takes ownership of the congregation and that contributes in a variety of ways. And I think a lot of congregations sort of get locked into a fairly small group of leaders, and the pastor gets locked into the idea that without those folks, the congregation couldn't survive. And so I think self-consciously going after, for example, gifts and skills and dreams of other people in the parish, and then consciously sort of having conversations about, you know, how do we get beyond the 6 people to 30 people who have some functions in the congregation. I think the other thing to do is to figure out ways to have conversations with congregational leadership, which get them to understand that branching out into the community will redound to the benefit of the congregation, that there's going to be a payoff here, that there's some self-interest in being more visible in the community, being more connected to people in the community, having the congregation seen as a critically important community center in a variety of ways. All of that, it seems to me, is sort of in the self-interest of the leadership of the congregation.
One problem, we've got a couple of mega churches in our neighborhood, and sort of we're only a small part of their draw area.
Yeah.
So, you know, working with us directly wouldn't necessarily be more than some of the self-interest things that they're interested in.
Yeah. John, do you have anything to say about that question?
I think churches can sometimes be invisible to communities, or they're an enclave. Who would go there because, well, that's that kind of faith or that kind of person? You talked about the invisibility of the community assets. If the community doesn't connect, that also applies to churches. I don't know, this fits. Someone asked earlier, what can we do? But in Dallas, we lived there for a while, and there's the school, the neighborhood school that our kids went to. There was an African-American woman who would walk around the perimeter of the school, and she was praying for the school, you know, for the kids, for the teachers. And, I mean, after a while, it takes time. But that, like the three ladies in Chicago, you know, they know what's going on.
Yeah.
And which is, as a pastor, I can get so stuck in my office,
yeah.
The cubicle, and I got to get out of there and into the community and course, we're looking for ways to do that productively or efficiently.
Yeah.
But maybe to waste time, and as we might say, and walk around and don't pray for your congregation and help you find a neighborhood school. I mean, just walk, just be out there, have a presence, and over time, you meet people, people will meet you, and out of that, needs can be discovered, but not just the needs thing, also the assets.
Yeah. Great.
But it's slow work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in our efficient society, that's also, it's wasting time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we got to waste time, you know?
Yeah, right. But it refers back to what I said this morning, where the burden is light. I mean, that seems like
yeah.
such a light burden, but where is that going, you know? So.
Yeah. Dwayne?
How did that congregation that Seattle started out talking about the pastors that they were?
I think I started with Bethel New Life in Chicago. Yeah, okay. They really started with their assets. They decided, you know, we got a choice here. We're either going to move to the suburbs and stay white, or we're going to stay here and transform because the neighborhood's now becoming all black. And they stayed, and you know, they decided, how are we going to do this? We got to save the neighborhood, or we're not going to have a neighborhood to be a church of. And they started out by, after Sunday services, getting the 20 or so people who were willing to do this to walk down the block, pick up carpentry skills and plumbing skills and drywalling skills, and they had bought for $100 a falling down three-flat apartment building, and they spent 6 months after church every Sunday with volunteers rehabbing it and turning it into a livable, affordable place. They rented out those three apartments, began getting income. With the income, bought a second building and a third, and you know, just sort of continued to march on. At one point, very early on, they took a look at what assets they had and how they could acquire another half dozen buildings to rehab, and they mortgaged their church. They figured out they owned their church, so they put the church under mortgage and borrowed enough money to buy a half a dozen buildings at one point. So they've built on their assets, and they're just wonderfully asset-focused people. They can never look at a garbage-strewn, terrible-looking, empty lot and not see two things there, or at least two things. Number one, they see a recycling business, right? And number two, they see a community garden or a site for affordable housing or something that's going to make the community better.
And eventually get the community to come into the church.
Yes, because they became, they put themselves at the center of positive activity in the community. The community is the church now in lots of ways. It's an African-American congregation that's absolutely vibrant. And I think that's, you know, I mean, the bottom line here, we should probably think about stopping because it's lunchtime. This way of going at community work is not the only way, but it's not, I hate the word model, because I don't think it's ever cookie cutter. I think it's stuff that gets invented in a variety of ways. It's not a set of programs, but it is, I think, in a way, a set of perspectives. And it's a set of perspectives that I think we've become convinced provides what maybe is the most powerful engine for building strong communities, which is hopeful people. There's a lot of places that just are hopeless, where people are hopeless about what can be done. And it's because they haven't had the experience. And so it seems to me that rebuilding hope is, at least in dealing with a lot of our communities, is the ultimate sort of challenge. And this way of going at it often, not always, creates a lot of people who are eager to get up in the morning and do the community building work because they see the possibilities. I suppose the last thing I'd say is hope is not optimism, right? I hate being called an optimist. I think optimists are, you know, tend to work in the ether. Hope is reality-based. The glass half full, half empty is reality. It's a realistic view. It's true that both the empty part and the full part exist. And the question is, what's the useful part? What part do you start focusing on? Do you get caught in focusing entirely on the empty part, or do you start with the hopeful part, which is the full part? Speaking of fullness, there's lunch.